This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Most complained adverts in 2017.
I'm going to start an agency that treats everyone with decency and respect and is really supportive like a family.
I don't care what you have to explain to your children, they're not my problem.
We all have a personal brand irrespective of whether or not we choose to control it.
It is the 25th of December. It is Christmas Day. You are probably unwrapping all of your presents. Hopefully you've got lots of presents and eating some, it depends where you are in the world. If you're in the UK, you're probably eating some turkey, somewhere cold like that. If you're in Australia, as I am, you are probably eating some prawns, seafood, maybe a few things on the barbecue. But welcome to the final Simon Dell Show of 2017. We have reached the end of the year and we have managed to survive to record our final podcast of the year. And this week we are going to examine disagreements. Christmas is a time for family arguments and drunken brawls in the front yard. And we're going to look at disagreements and the art of disagreeing and some of the adverts in 2017 that have incensed people enough to complain about them. That's in the spin cycle. Our long form interview today is with Taryn Williams. Now, if you go and look up Taryn on LinkedIn, you will see a fantastic history of entrepreneurship, of building businesses. She started off actually as a model when she was 15 years old, went on to build her own modeling agency, which she still runs today, and has now launched a platform for models, makeup artists, creative people in that industry to connect to each other, and is rolling that out with venture capital money and help across the world. It is a fascinating story. She is a remarkable and very intelligent young lady. And I think you will learn a huge amount from her. I finally just want to say the usual thank yous to everybody, obviously to Eddie and Patrick for all their help with the spin cycle this year. Gilberto, who is the unsung silent hero of the Simon Dell Show, who does all of our sound engineering and producing. If you want to check him out, welovesound.audio. He is a remarkable man when it comes to sound. If you would like to follow us, please do. We have our own Instagram page, The Simon Dell Show. You can talk to me on LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook. Email simon@simondell.com. Some people have emailed me and given me some fantastic compliments and some tips and hints, and I really appreciate that. So if you've got some questions or some suggestions, we'd really love to hear them. Finally, that's pretty much all I have for the introduction. Just hope you have a fantastic rest of your Christmas, and let's get into the spin cycle. Once again, we've got another episode of the spin cycle, and welcome back to my co-hosts, my wonderful co-hosts. And this week we have the plump stuffed turkey of co-hosts, Dr. Edwina Luck.
Oh, you're saying she's fat.
And we also have the Brussels sprouts.
Oh, here we go.
Of co-hosts.
You know, if you roast Brussels sprouts
Channel
in the oven.
Channel 7's Patrick Condren. How are you both?
I'm very well. We'll
I
get
am
to the
fabulous.
I want to explore this image in your mind of Eddie as a turkey, stuffed turkey. How's that work?
It was my Christmas themed introduction.
I'm plump with ideas, but Pat, I'm like you. Roast
Brussels sprouts.
I'm actually cooking them for Christmas Day with bacon.
You put a little X on top and fill them with bacon.
Oh man, of course, you bet. They're amazing. So and I think you've won the intro this week.
That's the nicest thing I've ever said to
you.
Well, let me finish up. Hey, I don't know about you, Ed, but they give me a fair bit of wind at the back end. So I become like a dog, one of those cattle dogs that's eaten too much kangaroo meat and no one wants to sit beside me. But by the time I've got the Brussels sprouts moving through, I'm too pissed to care anyway.
You like a bit of controversy, right, don't you, Pat? I can imagine you at the dinner table around whether it's Christmas Day or at a dinner party. Do you often disagree with someone even if you don't want to disagree with them about something?
I do, and I think the art of disagreement is dying, and I blame a lot of it, and I think you can these days blame a lot of it on social media and the instant interaction that you get back from computers and websites. And I have long practiced this, and sometimes it ends badly, but more often than not, it ends pretty well, and you end up with a lively discussion. So, for example, the three of us were sitting around with our significant others around a dinner party. So there's six of us, perhaps, having a nice dinner out under the stars. And someone says something, and I might agree with them, but I will deliberately take the opposite point of view in an effort to stimulate a conversation. Sure. Now, when I was doing this back in Rocky days, Ed, millions of years ago, when you and I were knocking around together, not knocking in that sort of sense, but hanging around, not just hanging around together. I know you were desirous, but I rebuffed your advances with monotonous regularity. But you'd sit around at a barbecue and you could have these conversations and you wouldn't get labelled a lefty or a righty or a fascist or a commie or a racist or,
or
all these derogatory terms these days. But it's too easy sometimes when you're having a conversation with people who might not be the sharpest tools in the shed. They've picked up this language, and I think it particularly comes from the right. I'm not saying that the left is anything to blame, is without blame, but it comes particularly from the right. And when you've got someone, for example, like Donald Trump in the White House, who talks about fake news, who talks about major mainstream media organisations, and he claims they've got it wrong. And we saw that happen recently in the Middle East, where he said that something was wrong, and the regime in that part of the world decried CNN. And so I think it's an art that's is it an art? It's I think it's a thing that's dying, and it's because of the social media. And I think more people should take an alternative point of view to stimulate discussions. For example, our politicians. Too often these days we don't exchange ideas. It's all about rhetoric. I think we're a poorer society for it.
We are, and it's a popularity vote, I think, for our politicians.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely.
If they're not popular and seen as being funny or going on, you know, XYZ TV shows and being funny or being on Twitter, then they're not marketing themselves, which really comes back to marketing. Everything does.
And a lot these days is, and it's not just politicians, but it's people are frightened of offending others.
That's very true.
Particularly, for example, you're an organisation that is trying to sell a product. You will do it as blandly as possible because you don't want to offend people. You don't want people to get the hump. You want them to come and buy your product. So, is that too simplistic, do you think?
Yeah, but maybe a little bit too simplistic. I mean, if you're it depends on what, if you're trying to sell a service, say as a legal product or a haircut, you know, they're very, very different things rather than a tangible product. So, you know, it's different. But, you know,
you look at some of the ads that have been made this year, and one that I'm looking at particular talks right at the moment saying, it says, print isn't dead. These seven great ads show the medium at its best in 2017. And there is images of Burger King's on fire, stores on fire, and the branded caption is, flame grilled since 1954. And there's firemen standing around.
Is that one of the best ads or the good worst
it says
ads?
It describes it as a great ad. And I'm really conflicted because you think, obviously they wouldn't be using a fire where someone was hurt or
but it's real fire.
But it's a real fire.
Burger King have always done that. Standing,
there's firemen standing around with their hoses out and there's, you know, extender ladders. I was absolutely flummoxed. But you don't see that sort of bravery too often these days.
And I think one that stands out to me a couple of weeks ago was the ad campaign for it's the lingerie shop.
Victoria's Secret.
Sorry?
Victoria's
Honey
Secret.
Burdette. No, Honey Burdette.
Oh, right.
And it had adverts with women modeling the clothing at a Christmas party.
Yes.
The guys that were surrounding these women were all in their suits and dressed in normal office wear, and the girls were prancing about at this office party
in beautiful underwear,
beautiful lingerie. Yes. And the challenge was people had asked Westfield to ask them to remove them because they felt it gave
derogatory
for females and
yes.
You know, and the children who were looking at that would start to feel that women are only, only useful for their
sex
looks
object.
And sex objects and that kind of thing. So
they were beautifully shot, but yeah, they were a bit.
But it's amazing
there.
How quickly that kind of thing reacts. Now the challenge is with that, as Patrick says, is that you can't disagree with that, because as soon as somebody turns around and says that's sexist or that's misogynist or that's treating women as sex objects. So if you go, well, I don't think it is, you're immediately seen as
sexist.
That same polarizing
or the lefty
opinion,
or the person. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And the thing is, we used to, you know, back in the caveman days, we used to sit around the gods, Aristotle, all those guys, and girls, they'd hang out and chat for days and debate things.
Aristotle was a bugger for the bottle, so you can understand why.
I don't think you can only blame social media. I think there's other aspects, because you know we live in an integrated society where there's lots of different media and lots of different touch points that we get our information. But unfortunately, and it doesn't matter about being smart or being articulate. It's about what we see and what we choose to see in the media that's going to influence our opinions and our attitudes. And then we take those, of course, and possibly, as you say, without fact and without the full story and certainly not the full context, and then we say, well, no, I think this. Whereas I think a lot of research needs to go into, well, first of all, a story that you want to argue, but also looking at, it's not about arguing. I actually said that to my daughter today. We were discussing the environment and climate change. And I said, it's not an argument. You know, there's two sides of the story and there's history. So you've got to look at both sides.
I think
you can have a discussion without having an argument.
I would challenge you and say, perhaps Patrick's point about that we've lost the art of disagreement is, we've actually lost the art of agreement. We've lost the ability for disparate opinions to come together and find some sort of common ground.
I love that positivity,
and
Simon.
I was listening to
it's so unusual.
Exactly. Yeah,
he said very negatively.
He's changed now.
I was listening to a podcast, another podcast, got the Epsilon Theory podcast today. And it's one of the episodes called Make America Good Again. And it talks about game theory. And I'm not going to dwell on it too long because I can't remember it all in, you know, the detail that they explained it. But there's a game theory called the stag and the hare. And the theory is that if we all work together as a group of hunters, we can go out and hunt a stag every day. And we can bring that stag down and we can bring it home and we can all have a fantastic meal.
Nom, nom.
Nom, nom, nom. But if one of us doesn't...
I hate that expression.
But if one of us doesn't want to partake, is being lazy or wants the day off or something like that, he can go and catch a hare instead because they're plentiful and they're easier to catch than a stag. But the problem is if he catches a hare, they need everybody to catch the stag. So if he catches a hare, nobody catches a stag. And one of the theories of this sort of game theory is that we've gone into a society where we're all chasing the hares, and we've forgotten how to work together as a group to how to put our disagreements aside, to, you know, look beyond all
for
those,
the common good, you
know, for the common good. And we've lost our ability to go and hunt a stag together. Mm. And all we're doing is all of us are chasing hares. Now, we're still getting fed, you know, but hare gruel isn't as good as a stag on a spit. But everyone seems to be happy with it.
I much prefer venison too.
Well, absolutely.
Well, that is interesting because I was reading a story at a lecture delivered at the Lowy Institute Media Award dinner?
That's
is that
correct.
Right, Pat?
Yes.
In September in 2017, and it was that you need to understand. You need to understand well before you can articulate whether it's an argument or a disagreement or just your story. And isn't that interesting? Because we're talking about bad advertising and good advertising, what is the objective? Do we understand our target audience? Do we understand what we're actually trying to achieve and trying to do before we do it? So,
and to segue on to the other part of tonight's discussion, that then brings into question what we were talking about earlier, which was the most complained about ads in Australia in 2017. Because number one, for those out there that don't know, we will put this up on our Instagram. But number one was the Ultra Tunes fifth advert. And for those that don't know, the Ultra Tune adverts are targeting men who like cars. And subsequently, the two fit ladies that feature in all of the Ultra Tune adverts tend to wear
skimpy outfits,
not necessarily handkerchiefs because they're sometimes all in PVC.
Yeah, but suffice to say, PVC.
Suffice
for years
to say,
they've been doing it. At least they're consistent. I will give them that.
And
good
the guy
on.
Behind the advert goes, "That is what our target market wants to see,
absolutely.
And that is what appeals to our target market." But yet, year after year, people complain about them. Mm. So, should we just sit there and go, "You know what? You don't like the adverts? Don't look at them.
Yes, turn them off."
Or should we be saying, you know, innocent children could be exposed to women in PVC and cover their eyes and ban all adverts?
Which I think is
nanny state gone mad.
Yes,
absolute bonkers.
Would you have taken the adverts out of Westfield? Would you out of the I've forgotten the shop again, Eddie?
Honey Burdette.
Would you have said to Honey Burdette they had to take those adverts out of their shop?
No.
You know, probably
and,
not.
And, but
no,
Maddie and I were.
Because
will,
they were
Maddie
funny, because Christmas parties are, there's been histories of lots of things that happen at the Christmas party stays at the Christmas party. And look, they're beautifully shot ads. And, okay, maybe they needed a bit of sense of humour with their copy, I don't know, but look, I don't get offended by much. I will tell you that now. I'm pro women, but I'm also pro men and pro latex. So, you know.
you can walk around the city, as I was doing with my 17-year-old the other day, and doing some shopping, and there was a storefront full of women wearing sexy undies. It was for an adult store.
Yeah.
We went through Myers and DJs and there's mannequins, you know, there's an underpants section, there's an underwear section. I mean, goodness me, what next? We're going to be covering that up. Oh, I mean, it's just, to me, it's bonkers.
Years ago.
You can sit down and have a conversation with the kid.
Yeah.
You know,
of
I said, Maddie
can,
said, don't look, Dad. I mean, we treat it as a bit of a joke. I don't think it,
I totally agree with you. I go, you know, it was one of the ones. Do you remember the two guys that were in the gay advert? The two gay guys that were in the advert.
Yes,
is it the roll on responsibility? Yeah.
Yes, that was it. And and everyone wanted them banned because, you know, my children might see them and ask awkward questions.
That's the whole point.
Well, exactly. And a lot of people turn around and said, I don't care what you have to explain to your children. They're not my problem. You know, this is, you know, you deal with your children. That's what
you're parenting.
Parent. You raise them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Everyone's got a gay friend. Everyone's got a friend.
Oh, I don't.
Always. Yeah, right. Okay. Really? Well, you need to get out.
So, anyway. I just want to touch on some of these other.
List them out, please.
The most complained adverts in 2017. So, number one, Ultra Tune. Apparently, Ultra Tune got a record number the previous year. It just doesn't say how many it were, but they didn't quite manage to top their record this year. So they must be disappointed in that.
Yes, they must be.
They got 359 complaints this
in
time.
In a population of almost 20 million people.
Yeah.
Was the ad pulled though, Simon?
Despite numerous complaints and lengthy disagreements by the Watchdog's board members about its execution, the complaints were ultimately dismissed. One was YouFoods. So YouFoods have been running some various campaigns, billboards and TV and those kind of things.
Get awareness, yeah, absolutely. Wanting to get some traction.
And they had a young boy impersonating Gordon Ramsay in the adverts. And
of makes course, sense.
He used the word forking twice in the advertisement. And that had 304 complaints.
Yes. And those people that complained, I would not want to have at a dinner party.
The interesting thing is that complaint was upheld.
Was it?
So, yeah, absolutely.
Well,
why?
Maybe it was on at 5:30 kids viewing time, 3 p.m. maybe.
What I then find interesting, and you're like this, is the third most complained about advert this year was another YouFoods ad that got 232 complaints. Complained about for exactly the same reason for the word forking, but they actually beeped it out and it still got complaints and it still got banned.
That's upheld. Bonkers.
Upheld. Wow. That's very interesting.
That's bonkers.
I know.
Have you ever watched a show called The Good Place?
Yes. Yes, I've just started watching that, actually. Yeah, I'm about five or six episodes in.
Because it's Tuesday, we're having tacos at home tonight. And Maddie was walking around the kitchen helping, you know, get the tacos ready, and she was reciting the lines from The Good Place. Forking this and forking that. I can't say forking. Well, what's going on? Yeah.
But then, see, Maddie's a late teen, so I can understand that, and I know forking is not really a word, but for a five-year-old, I kind of
not in this day and age, Jenny.
But we need to protect them a little bit, and I don't mean bubble wrap. And I know that's a conversation for 2018.
It's about parenting. It's about parenting, and I think
and it's humor. I know it's coming across as humor, and I know kids watch it on YouTube. And it's hilarious, and it's not taken seriously in most cases.
Don't look up the bin chicken song then.
Oh, good, I won't.
No,
but,
don't
you
do
know,
that.
With children, you have to be mindful that they do believe everything they see up until probably the age of 12.
You've got two contrasting ads there. You've got a kid saying a word that is not offensive, that is not a swear word, and then you've got an ad with women dressed in latex.
that wasn't banned.
That wasn't stopped. But you've got a kid saying forking. I wonder if that child is allowed to sit down and watch the Forkers.
Watches Bart Simpson. So I totally agree with every point I'm putting forward. No, but Brisbane banned. We had this ridiculous ad of a guy lying in bed with big Y front. They were like even the old Bonds undies. And he wasn't sexy or anything, but that the back of a bus, and that was banned. And that was probably 5 years ago. And I know when we're talking about 2017, so we'll get back to the future. But, you know, crazy. It's crazy what we ban and what we don't ban.
Number four on the list was the sport.
You're soldiering on.
Thank you, Simon.
I'm only going to get to five, and then I'm abandoning this. Sports bet was fourth. With 202 complaints.
No,
they should be banned completely.
Well, this was the one
TV.
With. I don't know if you remember. This was the one with Ben Johnson. The
appalling, absolutely appalling.
He put the roid in Android.
Yes.
So that
but I think was, any of those ads on the TV at times when children are watching is appalling.
Yeah, but for us who are old and know what Ben Johnson did.
I thought it was hilarious.
It's hilarious, but holy heckers, it's unethical. And didn't they do another one as well, Simon?
Well, if they did, it didn't get. Maybe it's not listed in my complaint file here. Mm. Number five was the Neds, which was another gambling app.
I think the gambling ones are shocking.
I think they're really awful. They should not be allowed.
No.
To be shown.
YouTube cracked me up fun. Because.
I know, aren't we? Here you want to ban
gambling ads, but you don't want to ban other stuff. They're all vices.
When it comes to forking, people don't spend their limited salaries when kids are starving at home just so they can go out and get a fork.
That's right. Actually, some other really bad Coke. I mean. They're shocking. Kellogg's LCMs also did a really shocking campaign appealing to children.
Tell her I'm on my way home.
Yeah, coming. You know, that pest of power type. Oh, I want the LCMs because they've got this really cool Halloween thing in them and, it's really great.
But that's advertising. That's the industry that you blokes are in.
Yeah,
that's advertising.
About bad advertising.
So I think we'll leave it with the one that I remember from my childhood, which got banned back in the UK.
And this is exciting.
It was an advert for Tango. And basically what it was is it was a guy drinking a can of Tango. And what they did was they stopped the camera, they rewound the camera, and then they played forward the camera in slow motion. And it showed the guy as he was drinking a can of Tango was this giant fat guy dressed in head to toe in orange. Came around very fast, and as he drank the Tango, slapped him around the face. Obviously, trying to indicate that he got that hit of orange when he drank Tango. Of course, what happened next day at every school across the UK was they were all going up and slapping each other, going, "You've been tangoed."
Oh,
that's hilarious. That is.
I remember Tango. It was like.
You remember Tang.
Tang. Well, it was the same kind of different.
Two different things.
Tango was in a tin.
Classic. Yeah.
Tang was a powder that you mixed with water.
Yes.
Cold water.
Memory's going in a rage.
Yeah, Can we do something on Zimmer frames next time around?
Age care advertising next time.
Yes. We'll be back on 4BC if we're not careful.
Yeah. Thank you both very much for all of your efforts and hard work to a degree. In 2017.
Wow. That was aimed at me, wasn't it? That was a Brussels sprout sledge.
I'm plump. So
I just want your final New Year's resolution. What are you going to do? What are you going to do more of in 2017, Eddie?
I'm going to laugh more.
you will be if you're doing this every week. What about you, Patrick? What's your New Year's resolution for 2018?
I'm going to do more nice things that people don't expect me to do.
Well, that's every day.
Or you're going to do some nice things that people expect. Because
random acts of kindness, Patrick.
When you use the word more.
Exactly, Eddie.
Random acts of Patrick.
Random acts of kindness.
Right.
And trying to be more understanding of people who describe me as a fucking Brussels sprout.
No, just a Brussels. I didn't use that.
What about you, Simon?
A forking Brussels sprout. Do you know what? I've got, 10 days, 11 days to think But I'm contemplating not having a drink for 2018.
What?
Wow. Why? Has it finally caught up with you?
A whole year.
Are you not a good person?
No, it's not. I don't have a problem with drinking, but I'm just contemplating not drinking.
That denial's the first sign that there is a problem. You know that, don't you? And you complain about me allegedly burping. I mean, all I can hear all night is the can of of stubbies being opened.
You can't hear the clinking of the ice in the glass. No.
Yes.
That's
is it a health or is it?
No. It's more of a weight issue. I'm just, you know, it's kind of.
Why are you safe anymore?
Well, 1 kilo a year, they say.
Yeah, and I can't afford
a kilo a year. What for?
Putting on weight. That's what happens when you get in your mid years.
By living.
Yeah,
by living. Yeah, because we go, oh, I should go to the gym today. Maybe I
won't.
I should go for a run.
Yeah, that sounds like mine. Anyway, thank you very much, guys.
We will
see
you.
We
will see
you
in 2018. Thank you very much, and take care. Have a good rest of Christmas and New Year. Okay, so I'm joined by Taryn Williams, who has a very long and interesting story that I'm not going to even begin to tell you. I'm going to leave that completely to her. So welcome to the podcast, Taryn.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we're going to start off. What I'd like you to do is give us that kind of elevator pitch, assuming it's a fairly long elevator ride, because there's obviously a lot for you to tell us. But if you could give us a real quick, 2-minute summation of who you are and what you do, that would be cool.
Of course. So obviously my name's Taryn Williams and I'm the founder and CEO of two different companies. My first business is Wink Models, which I founded about just over 10 years ago now, which is very much a traditional offline modelling agency. We have offices in Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane and about 650 models Australia-wide. And my second company is an online marketplace for creative talent called The Right Fit. And we have about 6,500 talent Australia-wide, everything from photographers to hair and makeup artists, social media influencers, actors, dancers, pretty much anything that you need to bring a creative campaign to life. And that company is about 18 months old and we're venture capital backed by Airtree.
Very nice. How do you split your time?
I work 100% in The Right Fit. So as you may have seen from emailing me at my old Wink address, it will bounce back. So I stepped out of that business about 18 months ago. Running a two-sided marketplace like The Right Fit really does take all of my time and energy. And I have an amazing team at Wink Models who make all of the magic happen on a day-to-day basis and keep the wheels turning. So I still own that business. I just don't work in it in the day-to-day business.
How much do you contribute to it? Do you just sort of rock up and annoy everyone with changes and then walk back out again?
Yeah, I have a once a week meeting with my managing director there for about an hour. And apart from that, they're pretty much completely autonomous without me. So we have a monthly board meeting, obviously, and check in. But apart from that, the business goes on without me. Unfortunately, I'm not as indispensable as I thought.
How do you feel about that?
It was really weird. I think obviously stepping away from it, I call it my firstborn, you know, it was like my first child and I do have so much love for that business. And I did spend so many years obviously growing it and giving it my all. And, you know, I absolutely love our talent and our team and our clients. But it is really fantastic to be able to step away from a business and have it go on without me. And I spent a lot of time building systems and processes to make sure it sort of removed the key man dependency in that business. So it's nice to know all of that hard work paid off.
Do you think that is the key that allowed you to step away, those systems?
Definitely. So I built an end-to-end onboarding, calendar management and payroll integration software for that business about 4.5 years ago. And it really allowed, firstly, it allowed the business to scale, but secondly, it removed the key man dependencies and the opportunity for human error. So without building that platform, it would have been impossible for me to step away from that company. So definitely, whilst it was a really painful and expensive exercise, it's definitely something I'm really glad that we did.
Just want to touch on that. When you say you built it, clearly you didn't build it.
No, clearly I am not. I'm not a developer. I don't code personally myself.
I don't want to say I don't want that to sound rude to say that, you know, clearly you're not a developer, but I know you're not a developer. Yeah. How did you go? I mean, that's obviously a big project.
Yes, it is. And I'd never built anything even similar to this before. You know, basic websites was sort of where I'd got to in scoping and building and wireframing a project. So it was a massive undertaking. It took about 18 months and it was completely standalone custom build. So I went through the process of obviously going out to market, getting some competitive quotes and tenders and looking at what it might look like and trying to figure out what sort of platform we'd want to build it in and that it needed to be scalable and really sort of sitting down and mapping out all of the features and functionality that I needed for the platform to have in order for it to really be able to manage that company. So it was a pretty extensive process. As I said, it was pretty painful. Obviously, I hadn't built a tech product before, so there was a lot of things that I had to learn the hard way along the way. Completely transformed that company, and it now really manages everything from sort of overtime to expense claims to, you know, all of the onboarding process for our new models, and really streamlined things.
What made you pick, because obviously you said you went to the market to, mm-hmm. to look at some providers who could build this sort of thing for you. What made you choose the provider that you chose in the end to do it? Was it a price decision?
It was a combination of things. I was really looking for someone who had experience in building two-way responsive SMS platforms. So obviously we have a really fast turnaround time. I knew I didn't want it to be a mobile app. It needed to be a web-based application because my team in the office will be building briefs on desktop. So it needed to be mobile first responsive, but not a mobile app. And I was really looking for development houses that had experience in building a two-way responsive SMS platform to check availabilities and rostering and scheduling based on a two-way SMS platform. So managed to find a company who'd built a sort of similar type of platform for a mining development company who had fly-in, fly-out workers and needed to check availability and scheduling and book people based on qualifications, which is very similar to the sort of breakdown we were looking for.
Okay, so I'm going to take you now back to the very start. You went to university and mm-hmm. you did international business.
Yes, I did politics and international relations.
That's interesting. I did politics as well, but a lot before you did politics. Why that? What sort of drove you towards that?
I was actually in Japan and had to decide what I wanted to do at uni. So my parents had moved house. I finished high school in Yeppoon, a tiny little town just outside of Rockhampton in far north Queensland. And my parents had moved house while I was away in Japan and sort of said, look, you need to decide what you want to do at university, because they were moving to the Southern Highlands and in New South Wales, and they said, look, there's nothing to do here, so you can't possibly live with us. You'll need to move out and go to university and decide what you want to do.
I just want to clarify that. That you went away and they moved house. I presume they told you they were doing that. It wasn't like...
No, they kind of just kicked me out of home.
You got home and found they'd gone.
Exactly. Turfed out on the street. There was my year of, lounging at home gone. So I sort of knew I loved economics and politics and modern history. And I knew I wanted to travel. I knew that I wanted to, I probably had some sort of indication that I wanted to own my own business or be somehow autonomous in what I did. And thankfully got quite a good UAI and had special acceptance to quite a few courses that I could do in a shorter time sort of frame. So, I was really drawn to international relations at ANU, had a great reputation. It was a relatively new course. And I thought, well, I've never been to Canberra. I'll just move there and enroll at university. That was about the extent of my decision-making process.
Fair enough. And... Has anything you learned in those years actually come in useful? Because for me, learning politics and doing politics at university, the only thing that's come in useful is my ability to argue with people about it. That's all it's done for me.
Yes, look, I would agree with that. And lots of people do come to me and ask for advice on what they should study, if they want to run their own business or be an entrepreneur. And look, I think there's definitely some things that you need university qualifications for. Like, obviously, I would love my doctor to be university qualified. There's definitely certain things that require that
as opposed to have educated himself via YouTube.
Correct. Yeah. But look, I think that there's lots of things where on-the-job experience is much more relevant and much more practical. So I think it's having a balance of the two. Look, I think it taught me a lot of things. It taught me how to jump through hoops. It taught me how to follow instructions. It taught me how to work to timeframes and deadlines. But was it probably the best use of my time? Possibly not. But look, I think to each their own. And I think some people really thrive in those environments. And I think perhaps it's an age thing as well. I was 17 and, you know, I think taking some time out and maybe coming back as a mature age student might have been more beneficial for me.
Yeah, I also have a law degree and I walked out after 3 years and just went, no, never doing that again.
Never going to use that. Hang it on the wall.
If anything, it taught me, 3 years taught me that that was what I was not supposed to do in life. So
yeah, long and expensive way to learn it.
Exactly. If someone had just told me on day one, we could have saved everyone a lot of pain. But talk to me about the modeling. How did that start? What was that one of those classic, you know, somebody spotted you on the street and, you know, or was it, you know,
doing those really glamorous like Westfield shows and catalogs when I was about 15, and sort of maintained it through high school, and then probably took it up a lot more seriously when I was at university. And I was traveling quite a bit throughout university with my modeling, and got some amazing, it affords you some amazing opportunities. I got to travel internationally and work with some of the most amazing, creative, talented people. And, you know, so it really did. It was really something that was very formative and shaped me and exposed me to lots of things that I suppose most of 16, 17, 18-year-olds don't get. So it was, it was definitely a really interesting period of my life and something that I look back on with a lot of fond memories. And especially as it was, you know, a little bit of a different time in the industry with big fat budgets and lots of international travel and, you know, all of the fun and raucous parties. So it was a little bit different to how it is now, I suppose.
What made you, when you were 15 years old, who was it that said to you, you know what, you should be a model? Was that something yourself with your own personal confidence, or was it something that your family said to you? Or
no, my parents were sort of innocent bystanders to the whole process. And they're incredible. They've been amazingly supportive of all of my decisions sort of personally and professionally over the years, and certainly had to bear the brunt of some of my crazier decisions. So, I was scouted. I had a girlfriend who was modeling at the time as well. And her agent sort of said, you know, you'd love you to come down and, get some shots done and see if this is something that you might be interested in.
Did you become more successful than her?
She doesn't model anymore, no. So, yeah, she sort of stopped when she was probably about, maybe 18, 19. Right. So it was different sort of career paths.
When you were doing that, obviously you have a personal brand, and you know that's obviously what a lot of people see. How did you go about marketing yourself in that? You know, I mean, obviously the agency do a lot for you, but was there some things that you did that you kind of went, this is going to help promote myself, this is going to get me more bookings, this is going to get me in front of more people? You know, were there things you learned from that?
And it's something that we sort of try and instill in our models at Wink as well, is that you really do need to carve out a niche for yourself. And that niche can change over time. Obviously, mine changed substantially over from my teens to my 20s to my mid-20s. And I think it's really important getting really clear about what your personal brand is. And, you know, my sort of early 20s, I was doing a lot more sort of beachy, surfy, swimsuit kind of campaigns. And then in my sort of mid-20s, that was much more commercial, banking, blue-chip brands. So it does sort of change over time, and really great models do really develop a personal brand, and that translates from everything from their social media to the type of shots that they'll put in their book to the brands that they associate with, so how they dress, you know, all of that's incredibly important. So, yeah, I think it's definitely something that great models will do and do well and understand and play to their strengths. Not to say that they can't be diverse and work across a range of different brands, but it's definitely easier for a client to visualize you as a young mom if that's sort of what your image and your portfolio portrays.
Is there something that you've taken out of that that you would apply to business now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think being in control of your personal brand, and this is it's something I speak on quite regularly, is that we all have a personal brand irrespective of whether or not we choose to control it. So every time someone engages with you, whether that's online or offline, they're buying into your personal brand and your journey and your values and your ethos and everything that you stand for. So I think as any kind of business person, whether you are a company owner or an employee, it really doesn't make any difference whether you've got a substantial following or not, or a substantial profile or not. It is about getting really, really clear about what your personal brand is and how you want to be perceived and how you can best shape and control and portray that if you choose to take control over it, because it's incredibly powerful. It is something that, yeah, people are engaging with and buying into, and you can choose to use that for your best advantage, whether that is to get a promotion or to get new clients or whatever it might be. I think it's definitely worth sitting down and mapping out who you are and how you want to be perceived.
When you made the shift from modeling to owning your own agency, was that because you saw a gap in the market? Was that because you saw that other people weren't doing it particularly well? Or
It was a combination of the both. So I obviously absolutely loved the industry, and it was something I was incredibly passionate about, and it had afforded me some amazing opportunities. But there were so many inefficiencies and inequalities in the industry, and talent didn't get paid very well. They didn't get paid on time. Generally, they had a pretty awful relationship with their agents, and agents generally had a pretty awful relationship with clients as well. And it just seemed like it could be done a lot better. From the blissful naivety of a 21-year-old. So, so I thought, well, I'm going to start an agency that treats everyone with decency and respect and pays them within 7 days and is really supportive like a family, and so that both sides of the equation win. Clients get a fantastic outcome because they have talent who are available and can stay in the industry because it's financially viable for them and want to do a great job because they know they're going to get paid on time. Okay. And on the flip side, talent obviously can thrive under circumstances like that. So that was the initial premise for Wink Models, and we still pay all of our models every 7 days, which is unheard of in our industry. And we managed to bankroll that for the last 11 years, and the company's grown year on year, every year for the past 10 years. So it's quite a feat, quite an accomplishment, something that I'm very proud of. And I couldn't have done it without the amazing support of both our clients and our talent.
How did you find that first 18 months, that first, maybe the first 12, 18 months? What were the sort of the challenges that you faced at that point?
Oh, it's incredibly challenging the first 12 months of business. You don't know what you don't know, which in hindsight is probably for the best, because if you knew how hard it was going to be, you probably wouldn't do it. So we were very lucky in that I had, you know, a great little black book of contacts on both sides, our client and talent, to launch with. And the very first campaign that we shot was a global print campaign for Nokia flip phones, back when they were the big thing. Which was really sort of fortuitous for us. We'd launched with a premise of being really ethnically diverse, trying to showcase a diverse range of beauty and looks and sizes and ages, and really skewed towards a commercial campaign look. So landing that campaign was obviously a huge win for the agency, and also afforded us the opportunity to bankroll the business and initial setup costs and building the website and business cards and things like that. And thankfully, you can run a business pretty lean in those first 12 months. Yeah. You know, we certainly didn't have offices or anything flashy to start with, and ran a pretty lean show. But yeah, it was incredibly challenging. I mean, you know, I vividly remember sitting up at midnight Googling the first 10 pages of photographers on Google, trying to reach out to them and cold call them the next day and say, you know, can we get our models in to see you for a go see, or, you know, do you have any campaigns coming up that we might be able to work on? Yeah. Can we have a meeting? And yeah, learning how to delegate, learning how to hire a team, there's so many challenges along the way, but you know, it's not supposed to be easy, I think, otherwise everyone would do it. And
absolutely. Talk to me about that cold calling. How did you, I mean, it's funny because I see a lot of businesses that those early days, that's one of the growth hack tips is, and you talk to a lot of recruiters as well, and they say the same thing, is that you need to pick up the phone and actually talk to people. Yeah. Was that quite nerve-wracking for you? Was that a challenge? I mean, nobody in their possible right mind likes cold calling. So how did you?
Yeah, look, I don't think anyone loves it. I've always been, you know, very inclined to say that building relationships is so important, and whether that's online or offline or over the phone, I definitely think face to face is super important, and I'll always strongly encourage my team to get out of the office and go and take a client for a coffee. You know, really build that personal rapport. So easy to get lost behind emails or social media these days that, you know, taking the time out to really personally connect with someone is so, so important. So, yeah, look, it's not fun. No one loves picking up the phone and cold calling. But, you know, and it's also the same as getting out of the office and going to networking events, going to functions and putting yourself out there and giving out your business card and cold approaching someone across the room. And it really does pay off. You know, it really, people really appreciate it. And I think, in general, people want to see others succeed, and they do, you know, if you're honest and open and transparent about, you know, what you're trying to achieve, people really do, in general, want to come on that journey with you.
What, on that cold calling front, what sort of success rate did you get? Did you just get people slamming down the phones, or were they all willing to talk to you?
Oh, gosh. A little bit of a mix of the... I don't think we ever had anyone who was, you know, terribly unhappy to take a call or...
Yeah.
And I think generally when you go in with a value add to their business, they can see, you know, we were really trying to solve this pain point for our customers. We knew that they weren't having a great experience. They were paying a lot of money to agencies and generally having a pretty poor outcome.
Yeah.
So they could see that we were really trying to solve that, and we were really vested in the success of their companies as well. We really wanted them to have a positive outcome, have great photo shoots and build better campaigns and remove some of the pain points for them. And so we weren't asking a lot of them.
Yeah.
We were really trying to solve something. So I think if you can go in with a value add, then people are pretty receptive to hearing what you've got to say, or at least, you know, being emailed some more information and catching
up. I think that's a fantastic point. I think if you're going to cold call, cold email, or cold somebody off whatever, off LinkedIn, or you've got to have something that makes you stand out. It's got to be you're solving a problem for them that you know that they have, and that's important. That I think the photographers sound like they were receptive because you already knew that they were getting a poor level of service from the industry. So, you know, they were more than willing to listen to you and, you know, and hear what you had to say.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to sort of take the time out and ask people's current experience as well. That's definitely something that we've done with The Right Fit, is really trying to unpick what the current user experience is for people who are trying to find and book creative talent for their campaigns. Is it too time consuming? Is it too expensive for them? Is there not the, you know, variety of talent that they need? Is it, you know, trying to really get to the bottom of the drivers for our clients, and then how we can, using The Right Fit, solve some of those pain points for them. So I think taking the time out just to meet with them and ask, like, what process do you go through at the moment? What doesn't work for you? What could we do to make that a better experience for you and save you time and energy and money?
Once you get over those early days, the really painful early days, what is it that worked best for you guys in terms of your growth over the last 10 years? What's got you more clients? What sort of activity?
Really, really ensuring that we were vested in the success of our clients' campaigns. So they knew that we would go above and beyond to make sure that their campaigns were a success. And that was everything from, you know, being available on the weekends if they had last minute changes that needed to come through, to following up and making sure that, you know, their castings had gone well. Was there anything that we could be doing better? And I think just absolutely over servicing and really being on their team, really being an additional sort of member of their production or their casting or their shoot, really takes a lot of the pressure off for our clients. And because of that, they've been fantastic in repeat clients and referrals. Yeah. You know, it really does make a difference when it's not just a transactional relationship. So
was there a point in those early days, was there a client that walked in your door and you kind of had that? I mean, I'm sure you do with all of your clients. I don't want any of them to feel any less loved than the other one. But was there one that you walked in and you just sort of, was that fist pump when you kind of realized you'd got it, or you were there?
Oh, there was definitely campaigns that we'd pitched on sort of for years. And yeah, when you finally land them, it's pretty rewarding. You know, some of the bigger magazines or, you know, when we have really iconic campaigns in market, you know, like Qantas and things like that, there's definitely those moments where you drive past a billboard or, see it when you get off the plane. You think, wow, that's pretty cool. That's, you know, we made all that happen there. That's our talent. So, and that goes for both businesses as well. You know, we definitely have those moments for the right fit when I'll see a campaign in market or an influencer campaign roll out. And I'm like, wow, that's, you know, all of this has come together to this actual outcome.
You get that warm, fuzzy feeling inside that was part of
and you thankfully guys. It sort of doesn't die over the years as well. It's definitely still gives me a buzz.
Explain the thought pattern that took you from Wink to the right fit. I mean, obviously there's a clear line there between, you know, what one does and what the other one does, but what made you sort of wake up one morning and go, you know, we could do something else? What, you know, that sort of went, I'm not satisfied or with Wink. How did that sort of evolve?
So on the back of building the onboarding and calendar management and payroll integration software, I absolutely fell in love with technology and using it to solve problems. And it's, as I said, it was sort of probably about an 18-month build. So during that time, our industry was changing a lot. There was obviously the advent of the social media influencer, and there was a move towards these smaller bits of snackable digital content being produced instead of these really big spend TVCs and print campaigns. And the type of talent that clients were requiring in campaigns was changing as well. So a lot of clients wanted, you know, real authentic customers of a brand, or you know, there was a lot of sort of leading indicators that our industry was ripe for disruption. And on the other side, we also had a huge range of talent approaching us for representation who didn't fit into any of our traditional buckets of a modelling agency. So there was kind of this supply and demand side problem on both sides. And I was like, well, if we could unite all of these people around a platform that could manage the transactions safely and securely for them and make sure that they got paid on time, which had obviously been the key driver at Wink, could we solve some of these problems for creatives? Could we find a better way for photographers to manage their careers and build a brand online? You know, we were seeing so many fantastic creative talent building out great social media profiles and websites and really trying to build a brand and monetize that, but really struggling because, you know, they don't have the time or maybe necessarily the skills all the time to manage the admin and paperwork and contracts and everything that go along with that. So it was sort of the premise of if we could streamline some of this process using technology, could we build a really scalable process for all of the creative industry and therefore remove the pain points for our clients that we're constantly having to call around to these highly fragmented supplier relationships to bring a campaign together, which was really costly and really time consuming for them and not financially viable when they're just producing high volume turnover online content.
Has the growth of the right fit been the same? Have you used the same techniques that you used to grow Wink, or is there something different that's helped scale this?
Yeah, so it's definitely a completely different sort of growth trajectory to Wink. Wink grew very organically, you know, over, it was always profitable. It was fantastic business. And as the business grew, we hired more staff, and as we took on more models, we got bigger offices, and, you know, all of those things sort of happened really organically over time. Whereas the right fit is definitely a high growth tech company with very, very different, you know, we've got 6,500 talent in just over 12 months. It's a very, very different kind of business. We do a much more aggressive marketing strategy. We have much higher targets and it's a bigger market opportunity. You know, we are expanding globally. We already work with international bookings and international clients. So it's definitely been a very, very different journey to the first business. And it's really exciting. I'm learning on a day-to-day basis, which is amazing. It's nice to be out of my comfort zone and challenged.
It's interesting when you look back and I interviewed Annie Parker, who's the CEO of Fishburners last week.
She's fantastic.
She's absolutely amazing. And she has this quote that she used about three times in the interview. And of course, I can't remember it. But the highlight, she says it's about, you know, looking, it's easier to understand your path when you're looking back rather than when you're, you know, yeah, right at the start looking forward.
So true.
I've hideously hacked that quote, and I apologize to Annie. But it's interesting when you, and one of the other things, Annie's comments on one side, and the other one is a book that I've mentioned several times in my podcasts by a guy called Cal Newport, who wrote a book called So Good That They Can't Ignore You. And he talks about career capital and about how those steps that you take in your career should be done on the basis of you building up capital in yourself and knowledge and experience and all those kind of things. When you look at yourself at 15 to where you are today, to me, there looks like a clear linear trajectory from where you were at 15 to where you are today, because everything seems to have been it's not necessarily an obvious step, but a step that relied on your experience from the previous role. Does that make sense?
It does. And definitely with the benefit of hindsight, you sort of look back and yes, it can look very linear, I think is a great word. And when you're in it, it certainly doesn't feel it.
I can totally imagine it doesn't feel blindsided.
You know, there's some amazing twists and turns I could have never predicted when I was starting out. But yes, definitely. It has been a really great journey that has certainly built on. And that's something that I think really focus on is this idea of just never accepting the status quo and never just wanting to be stable and constantly wanting to innovate and develop and looking for the new challenge and what's next and what's around the corner.
It almost looks planned. That's what I'm trying.
I wish I could say it was. No, it's just the day-to-day chaos of my brain.
I completely understand that it's not. But when you go, you started off in modelling and you learned about that industry, you then went to build a modeling agency because you'd learned about how to model and you learned about the industry, and then you went and built a platform, you know, that could help you manage that agency better, and then that platform then evolved into something. Do you see what I mean? It kind of feels like
it
feels like there was a plan when you were 15 that this was what was going to happen.
I wish I could say it was. I had no idea what I was going to be when I grew up. I still say I don't know what I'm going to be when I grow up. So.
No, absolutely. So, I think it's that Baz Luhrmann quote. See, some of the most interesting people who are at 40 and still don't know what they're going to do. So, I tend to hack people's quotes apart here because I can never remember them. There's a couple of other questions just based on some of the things you said. That social media influencer obviously has been a massive growth space in the last 5 years, give or take.
Yeah.
Is that something you think every business could tap into, or is it really something that, you know, it's more of a consumer brand space?
Great question. It's something that I get asked a lot. It's but there's a sort of misconception that influencers are really for consumer-led products, or, you know, that influencer marketing is all about beautiful girls on Instagram posting in fashion products or whatever. But we've always had influencers. They've just been different things in the past, you know, whether it was celebrities endorsing products or, you know, journalists are influencers. There's so many different aspects to influencer marketing, and it's about finding where your customer lives, what sort of channel is most relevant to them. Maybe it's LinkedIn, maybe it's long form blog content, maybe it is TV, maybe it's offline networking events, and then finding the right sort of influencer that can speak with authenticity and authority in that space. So if it's a pet food product, maybe it's a vet is the, you know, most relevant influencer for your brand. If you're trying to sell to, you know, a B2B play and you're looking for decision makers in recruitment, then maybe it's long form content on LinkedIn that is going to resonate with them. So I really do think that influencer marketing is so applicable in every different business. And I think it's about taking that time to sit down and map out as part of your marketing strategy and working out what success looks like, working out what you're trying to achieve, and then finding the right, most relevant person or people for you.
That's kind of answered my next question, because I was going to say, I was going to ask you, I said, if you were a B2B company, and And I want to talk about that one because I think B2Bs find it harder to get their head around the concept of influencers.
Yeah.
What would be the first thing if they sat down and said, right, you know, we're gonna look at influencer marketing, what would the first step be for a B2B company?
I think definitely sitting down and doing that analysis of who are we trying to talk to, who are our customers? Is it mid-tier? Is it senior management? Is it CEOs? Is it, and on the back of that, you know, what do they look like? What are their interests? Is there any sort of common demographic breakdown that we can utilize to find a way to speak to them in a way that's going to resonate and get cut through? Because obviously we're inundated with so much content on a day-to-day basis. What can we do to really capture their attention? And is that going to be an offline execution? Maybe we get them in a room for an event and have a fantastic international top tier speaker who can, you know, really add some kudos to our brand? Or is it, yeah, long form content? Is it, is there particular channels or that they engage with currently? Is there particular blogs that they're reading that they're inspired by? Is there particular podcasts, for example? And then working out a marketing strategy, with influencers incorporated into that, that can really get you cut through. So I definitely think that it's just about thinking outside of the box. And I think trying to get past that preconceived notion that influencer marketing is just on Instagram and it's just about pretty pictures. And if we don't have a product or a service that plays to that, then it's outside of our remit.
Who influences you? Who do you, or what channels do you get your information from?
Great question. Look, I love Medium. I love LinkedIn. Anyone that knows me will tell you I'm a massive LinkedIn fan, a massive LinkedIn stalker. and I love each of the different channels probably for different reasons. I don't use Facebook a great deal. I love Instagram for visual content and visual messages. Obviously, both of my businesses are incredibly lucky to have an amazing amount of beautiful visual content to utilize on those channels. So I do love both of those, but I love each channel for its ability to tell a different story so that I can utilize LinkedIn to really share experiences in my life and for my companies in a very different way than I utilize Facebook or Instagram. And obviously learning more about those through Growing the Right Fit and just how so absolutely data-driven you can get and so segmented you can get in who you're trying to reach on those different channels is so powerful.
Technology clearly gets you excited.
It does.
Don't worry, we're all like that. What technology gets you more excited? What do you read about a lot?
I'm pretty obsessed with AI at the moment. I think there's some really amazing changes coming in the short term. Blockchain as well, you know, I think there's cryptocurrency. There's some really amazing developments that are going to be really applicable to our day-to-day lives and our day-to-day living. So I think that, the more that we can all sort of read and learn and understand these things, the better. And I think that there's really easy ways that they can be applied on a day-to-day basis to make our lives better, hopefully. And I think that, I think it's going to be a really, really exciting, you know, short term. And I think this is, you know, I think people think about AI and they think, oh, yeah, we're going to have, I don't know, robots or servants in 10 years' time. But it's so much more than that. And it's happening now. And there's so many, you know, amazing developments that, you know, there's AI. I've just been looking at one. There's an AI EA kind of platform where you can have a virtual AI assistant who can look and learn about your current patterns and how to make your day more efficient and who you haven't caught up with, you know, recently and you know, manage your schedule and make you, probably more productive. So there's some amazing tools out there like that already exist that we can all be taking advantage of. So, they're probably my big ones at the moment.
I think I tend to get in quite a few discussions on Facebook with friends around self-driving cars, which is my two. I mean, I love the whole blockchain and the Bitcoin thing. And I'll come back to that in a second. But self-driving cars that people go, oh, you know, there's going to be an accident and then no one will ever want to get in a self-driving car. And I always make the point, I think it's 37 people every year in the US are killed by vending machines, but yet we still have vending we still have vending machines. You know, it's not like we're all scared of vending machines all of a sudden. But but especially with self-driving cars, I'm trying to sort of say to people, think about what car you're going to buy next.
Yeah.
And I say this absolutely seriously. I go, because there will come a turning point, and it will only take a year, 18 months maybe, when you'll be able to move from owning a car outright to having a subscription of a car. And that car will come and get you and drop you off where you want. And all of a sudden, owning a car will become a thing of the past. And if you've suddenly spent, let's say, $80,000 buying a car in 2018, that's going to devalue much quicker than it would have done, say, 5 years ago.
Absolutely.
And people need to understand that and think about it and think about the consequences of the impact of technology, not just in their personal lives, but in business. And really be aware of not necessarily what's here now, but what could be here in 2 years' time or 5 years' time.
Absolutely. I completely agree with that. And just looking to the landscape and seeing those leading indicators for change, because I totally agree with you. It's going to be relevant in so many different aspects of our lives.
The other question I've got for you is whether you bought any Bitcoin.
I didn't. No, I didn't. And I've been watching it unfold over the last few weeks, especially on social and yes, wondering did where you, I was when...
kick yourself, did you?
Yeah, look, I did a little bit. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that unfolds over the next sort of 6 to 12 months as well.
I put $3,000 back in August, early August, and I just wish I'd had the balls to put in all of the money that's sitting in my tax savings account right now.
Oh, gosh. Benefit of hindsight is it's always 2020, right?
Absolutely. Hindsight, as my father would say, hindsight is the only exact science. But okay, right. Last couple of there's one more business question I've got for you. When have you failed? Because, everything we've spoken about today makes you, makes it sound like there's never been any failures. And I'm really interested to understand something that went wrong, a big failure that happened, and what do you learn from it?
Oh, God, I've had so many failings on a day-to-day, yearly basis. And I think you're absolutely right. There's sort of this glorification of entrepreneurs and business owners where maybe we don't talk about, firstly, the hard times and how bloody difficult it is, and then secondly, all of the things we've all stuffed up along the way. So, I've had some really, really, I've had terrible hires where I've completely, absolutely misread perhaps someone's qualifications and skill set and completely mismatched them for a role, and then not let them go fast enough, which is obviously not a win for them and not a win for the company. I've definitely hired professional services that were not great. We definitely had some accountants a few years ago who were definitely not fantastic. And I think that there's always that desire as a, when you're a busy founder or CEO, that you just want someone to take responsibility. I was definitely guilty of sort of throwing it across the fence and being like, cool, you guys have got this, you're professionals, you're experts in your field, we're paying you lots and lots of money, so you don't need me to babysit you. And that was just a benefit of hindsight to look back and say, I definitely didn't manage that process well. And had to unravel and unpick that, which is always a pain, as everyone will know who's had to transition accountants or lawyers or anything like that. I've had some real shockers over the years, and it's just definitely about trying to look back on those moments and go, okay, what are the key learnings here? What can I take away from this? What would I do differently next time?
What do you do differently now you've had those experiences?
Yeah, across the board, I definitely have clearer reporting processes in terms of internally and externally. So when members of my team need to come to me for approval on things before they go out, or before new hires are made, or before big decisions, new office moves and things like that are made, there's a much clearer internal process there. Firstly, so that people feel like they can work autonomously and thrive and succeed and innovate and they don't have to run everything by me. But secondly, also to stop some of those major fuck-ups from happening. So that's probably one of the big learnings. Secondly is, to hire slow and fire fast. Definitely
I was just about to use that expression.
Take that time to really sound out new employees, spend some time together. It's incredibly difficult to know if someone's going to be the right fit. But
when you recognise that they're not really, and it's for the best of the individual and the company, because, you know, I've got a team of people that I need to look after on a day-to-day basis, and one person who's not thriving in that really, really does upset the entire team and have an impact on the whole business. So, yeah, I think just making those decisions faster and trusting your gut a little bit more have probably been some of the key takeaways for me.
Last three questions. What are some of the other brands that you like or admire or something that you might buy all the time that you just can't live without?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. I personally, I love La Prairie skincare. I think they have such an iconic, I absolutely love their branding, and they have such an iconic, true, they've stayed so true and so stable to what they speak to their consumer. They've never ever strayed from that. And I think that's really, really rare in that space in beauty and skincare, I think, to have really stayed so core for such a long time. And I think that makes them really iconic. And I personally just love their products. Oh, gosh, who else? What else do I want? Obviously, we're an Apple team. We all use Apple products. Yeah. I've got an amazing amount of respect for the attention to detail that goes into their products and their services. So I think that's one that you can't really fault. Their online and offline experience is pretty bloody incredible.
Do you pick up ideas from those brands? Do you see things that they do? I mean, obviously, the attention to detail with Apple, I think, is something that a lot of people learn from.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, I mean, I'm totally inspired on day to day. I mean, I subscribe to so many different sort of services and products just purely to see like their onboarding processes or their marketing material. And I love seeing what other brands are doing. It's so inspiring just seeing how people think outside of the box. Slack is one of my all-time favorites. Like even their app updates have fantastic, yeah. their messaging is so consistent and, you know, even their app updates are always like a little bit
nitty and funny. Yeah, I've highlighted their app updates frequently. Just the language that they use. It's
just that they take the time to. Just so on brand for them. So
yeah.
There's so many services like that that I'm just wowed by on a day to day basis. And it's so important to. Otherwise, you really operate in a silo, and it's really hard. You know, if you're not obviously engaging with other brands and services on a day-to-day basis and taking those things in, it's really hard to find inspiration. So, yeah, I think there's so many brands doing it well and so many companies doing it well that are just, and we're really lucky. We have some really great brands in the Australian market who are doing a phenomenal job. And, and I think as a user experience perspective as well, I'm always, you know, massively inspired by what other brands are doing and how they're making onboarding flows better or checkout experiences better. So
I've spoken to quite a few brands doing this podcast, but I think probably my favorite so far, and again, that's not to negate anything that any of the others guys are doing, would probably be Vinomofo, with Justin Dry and the team there. It just seems the love and the passion that sort of it seeps out of the pores of the brand.
Yes, and that they've managed to maintain that as they grow, I think, is really incredible, because it's something that could have been a sort of flash in the pan, cheeky website, and they've managed to maintain that and stayed really, really true to their core beliefs and their core customer without alienating sort of new demographics, which I think is really powerful.
What's next for you? Where the right fit, I'm kind of guessing, is at one of those points in its life cycle where I think it's the hockey stick analogy, the hockey stick graph, where it's going to go, if it's not already going, which I'm sure it is, but it's going to go almost vertical, like a Bitcoin growth, you know?
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
It's definitely the plan. And I mean, we've seen exponential growth this first 12 months of the business journey. And, you know, I could never have predicted that it was going to be as steep as it has been when we started out. So that's which is exciting, but obviously growth comes with its own pain points and challenges too. But yeah, look, we're expanding internationally, which is really exciting. And I'm, you know, really, really proud of everything that we've managed to, you know, we certainly never thought we would have 6,500 talent or just slightly more than that on the platform in such a short period of time. Yeah. And the campaigns that we've got to work on and the brands that we're working with is pretty awesome. So yeah, continuing to, obviously we're adding some pretty exciting and cool new features and branching out into new markets and continuing to build out the team. And so, yeah, there's some really exciting things on the horizon for us for the next sort of, even just a short term, three to 6 months. So, which I'm really, really excited to release to the world. So new features on its way.
Is there going to be another, do you think there'll be another raise next year?
Yeah, well, we've actually just closed a round. Okay. So probably not next year, but definitely, you know, in the not too distant future, just depending on how quickly we grow and the new markets that we can enter. So, yeah, it's definitely, you know, yeah, there's lots of deciding factors on when we'll raise next. But we have amazing investors, and it was really important to me to get strategic partners who really add value outside of just a cash injection. And, you know, I couldn't be happier with the people that we have around the table with us.
Does that change how you run the business once you have investors like that?
Absolutely. It definitely, you know, when we did the first raise, it was, I didn't need to raise capital for the business the first time. You know, we could have continued to sort of grow organically. And but what I really wanted was amazing brains around the table and a really sort of rigorous, rigorous reporting process, but asked to be really, really data driven from day one, and asked to be really, you know, this wasn't a lifestyle business. This was about building a high growth tech company. So that was one of the main reasons that we chose to sort of seek investment quite early. I mean, we were probably 3 months old when we did our seed round. So it was definitely about building out fantastic team and really running it at this hard. You know, we were first to market and it was amazing market opportunity, and I really wanted to take advantage of that. So it's definitely changed how the business is run.
It sounds like it's going to be an interesting 2018 for you.
Yes, I'm very excited. I'm tired just thinking about it, but I'm excited.
Do you get much time to yourself? Do you get a chance to sort of stop and breathe?
I don't. I'm trying to get better at that. I definitely don't have any sort of work-life balance. I think that's a bit of a myth. But, you know, this is sort of a journey that you choose to go on. And I know I wouldn't have it any other way if I wasn't doing this. I would have found something else crazy to throw myself into. So,
final question. If people want to talk to you, if people want to ask you something, obviously you mentioned LinkedIn. Is that's the best place to get you?
Yeah, connect with me on LinkedIn, or shoot me an email, taryn@theright.fit. Follow me on Instagram. I'm just at Taryn Williams, or Facebook.
Brilliant. That has been fantastic. And I think, you know, there's a huge amount of learnings from what you've done in your experience. So thank you very much for giving up your time for us
today. My pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been great to chat.
And good luck for 2018.
Thank you so much.
So that's it for this week. That's it for 2017. There is no more Simon Dell Show for 2017. We will be back in 2018, hopefully bigger and better than ever, with more interviews with some fantastic people, more Spin Cycle, lots of other bits and pieces. So thank you for tuning in. If you get the chance, please review and rate us on iTunes. If you're listening to us on any other platform, give us a thumbs up or whatever that platform happens to do to show your appreciation. So thank you very much for tuning in, and we'll see you all in 2018.